Hello and welcome to another episode of the Game Dev London podcast. My name is Stuart DeVille, he, him. I'm one of the directors of Game Dev London and I will be hosting today. And with me I have Chris. Do you want to say hello, Chris?
Hi. Hi, Stu.
How are you doing? You good?
I'm good, thanks.
Nice. So today, there's been a topic that I've wanted to talk about for quite some time. It's very kind of like top level when it comes to game development, but it's something that all game developers, well, certainly all studios and solo developers would need to consider. And that, so the way that I look at it currently is that there's roughly, it can be broken down into more, but there's roughly five stages of game development. And those consist of discovery, production, testing, release, and then post-release. Chris, what's your experience with this?
I'd say that's broadly accurate. I would say that obviously production is a massive beast and divides into a whole subset of separate things, but I think people are more familiar with that idea, and I think that having those five stages that span kind of like before production to after production gives a better idea of the lifetime of a game.
Yeah, I think like when you're new to game development and you're just like trying to make things for yourself, you probably just dive more or less into production. You kind of have like a vague idea, and you have the tools available to you, right? So you just kind of dive straight in, try making something, and get slapped with all of the the errors and the mistakes that learn as you go, I guess. Would you say that you kind of had that when you were starting out?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely a learning curve. I was more familiar with the technical stuff when I started in the industry 20 something years ago. I knew I could program. I knew like a lot of the basics of how game art worked and how the technical stuff came together. But the what I wasn't familiar with was the way that a team would work and all of the support stuff that happened around the actual making of the game.
Yeah. Yeah, that sounds, I would say, fairly typical for most people. Like you kind of have, even if you're new to it, like you learn very quickly how to make something. But when it comes to collaborating with other people, like if you wanted to jump into like game jams to improve your skills and stuff, then there's a whole extra skill set of working with other people. So with these five stages that we have here, like we've said, they invariably they can be broken down into like you can go into more depth. Like you can break discovery down into a whole bunch of things. You can definitely break production down into a whole bunch of things. Testing, release, and post-release. These can all be broken down into much, much deeper. We could do a much deeper dive on it, but it would take way too long to do right now. So we're just gonna give you like a general overview of all of these things. And if you guys like it, let us know, and we could even look at doing other episodes where we do deep dive into each section. But we'll start with discovery, and that's kind of where you come up with concepts for like your game mechanics and what we call like the meta game. Chris, how do you start with discovery?
It's an interesting one because the actual ideation generally happens while you're working on another project or while you're playing another game, and something, just the seed idea, just pops up of like, what if this game I'm playing had a grappling hook in it, and like, could you know, what mechanics would that allow us to play around with? So that idea is likely to bounce around in a designer's head for some time before they get an opportunity to actually try it out. So, and this is why companies will sometimes run internal game jams to get some like ideas out of their team's heads that might have been rattling around for ages, because occasionally they will come up with something that is truly inspired. Obviously, there's I'm going to bring up the classic trope of ideas are cheap, it's execution that counts. Which is partly true. It does require a good idea in the first place. No amount of like quality execution is going to make something work if the fundamental idea is flawed. But it does require it needs both, basically. You have to have a good idea in the first place, but then you have to execute it well.
So I think a lot of that comes from obviously trying to test out that idea locally, either internally or if you're not part of a team, then like with friends and family and stuff.
Would you
normally, because typically as part of Discovery, someone would start, well, I say typically, not always, you might start creating a design document. Is this where you would start creating a game design document, or would you want to be more sure of the idea first?
I would, for me personally, I would probably just start playing with the mechanics first, just to see if they work. So once I had a core idea, I would basically build a grey box test level and try the mechanic out, see if it's fun. Once that's working, that process will give me an idea of like any technical issues with the design that are going to be challenges to solve. It will sometimes reveal like fun ideas that you wouldn't necessarily have thought of if you hadn't actually played around with it first. A good example I like to use is Game Crackdown, which was basically an open world city in which you played like a superpowered policeman, and you could like leap from like building to building like across the city. Felt really distinctive. There's no other game like it, quite like it, but I've got a pretty strong feeling that came out of playtesting in the very early stages of the game. I'm willing to bet that started as an open world city that was designed as a typical Grand Theft Auto game. Somebody put in a mega jump to make it easier to get around the city during testing, and they found that the mega jump was so much more fun than than the core stuff, because that jump is the single mechanic that makes Crackdown really stand out and incredibly fun. So I like to think that's something that was discovered in the course of development, rather than something that was designed in from the beginning. But I could be wrong about that.
Yeah.
If the Crackdown developers are out there, please correct
me. Yeah. Did you intend for the jump to just be amazing?
Yeah.
So again, in the discovery phase, there's lots of stuff that we do. And although playtesting does tend to come in around production, we, as game developers, we do test constantly along the way, right? And then, so once you've got something that's fun, you would potentially, I guess, start looking at either the art style or the technology stack. So the things that you're going to need architecturally to build the game, and what art style you might work with. Is there a particular order that you prefer to go with those, or do you just kind of, depending on the game?
I think tech first, ideally, because that will inform what you can do with the art style.
That's true, yeah.
Because, you know, there may be limitations on, there's a whole bunch of considerations. You may find that, for example, if you're trying to make an open world game, then a simplified art style will make everything a lot easier, in terms of uh, the the like resolution of textures required. You like maybe you want to go for something that is like more flat shaded so that you don't have very many textures, which reduces the memory footprint and the streaming load and so on. But also the it depends on the mood of the game and so on. If you go for photorealism, apart from the like all of the like additional technical baggage of trying to make things look photorealistic in terms of like high-end shaders, high resolution textures, high quality models and so on, it also brings you need higher quality animations for those higher quality models because you know, if you've got cartoon characters, if you've got cartoon characters, you can get away with like not an easier animation because cartoon characters have their own particular requirements as well. But if you're doing photorealistic characters, then there's an expectation that they're going to have high quality facial animation as well. At the moments where that is appropriate. And if you go for photorealism, it also creates a higher expectation of affordances. So you would expect a room to be full of the sort of clutter that you would expect in a real room. Whereas in a more cartoony game, you can get away with a room that just contains a couple of like jars for rupees and maybe a cartoony bed and so on. And you'd be okay with that. Well, in a photorealistic style, that would look jarringly Spartan. So those are issues, but also it depends on the style. If you're doing something that is, if you're trying to create a mood that is kind of for a tense horror game, then photorealism generally works better because you can have all of that like grime and so on, and it creates that mood. If you're going for something that is a bit more light-hearted and jolly, then cartoon is probably better. But I will say we are seeing a lot more horror games in like more lo-fi styles, and they work just as well if everything is geared around that.
I played a game recently. I can't remember which expo it was I went to because I've been going to so many recently, but I think it was VR. And everything was in this like stylized artistic kind of lower poly. I wouldn't say it was low poly, but it was definitely lower. Like it wasn't high definition or anything. And it was actually the audio that was creeping me out. Like there was very well placed silence and very well placed like little sounds around and walking through corridors and stuff, and like a bottle falls over and like the sharpness of that bottle falling over versus all of the silence. I was jumping just from that. So it's definitely lots you can do.
Yeah, you don't have to. I mean, I would generally recommend that like photorealism should be almost like the way down the list as like the last. It should only even be on the list if you have like a budget in the millions nowadays. Because the hardware is powerful enough to handle near photorealism, but only if you've got a budget to deliver near photorealistic models, textures, animations, performance, audio. Everything has to be at that same level. And that's a big ask, which is why even high-end studios are like favoring more stylized looks for a lot of their games, because you can create a much more distinctive look and feel to the game with a stylized art style.
I think also there's a lot more you can get away with when you're not trying to be hyper-realistic.
Yes.
Because the more hyper-realistic you are, the more you have to tie it to reality, whereas the more fantastical it is, the less that's a consideration. Like even when it comes to the kinds of monsters and things that you can create when you're going hyper realistic, those become very tricky and difficult to do.
They do.
And the last part I've kind of got down here for for Discovery is this is where you do a lot of your planning. So you,
mm-hmm.
if you don't already have the team together, then you figure out the team that's needed to develop the game. A lot of indie studios, obviously, they have their core team and they know where to dish out that work, but there may be things that they want for the game that they would outsource that work. And then they want to start figuring things out, like how long it's going to take to develop the game, because
mm-hmm.
that can very much be a decider on whether or not the studio even takes on the project. And then we figure out things, deliverables, what we call deliverables, that are produced along the way. So what we're going to produce and when it needs to come in and how we're going to plug that in. And then finally, the budget breakdown. So how much we think all of this is going to cost us.
Yeah.
Does that sound about right to you? Is that roughly?
Yeah, I mean, part of the planning phase that we've kind of glossed over a little bit would be the scope definition. So once you've got an idea of I'm going to make a 3D platformer with a grappling hook, then you've got to decide how are you going to do that. Are you going to do like a linear series of levels separated by cutscenes? Are you going to make it a bit more Metroidvania, like the Zelda, earlier Zelda games? Do you want to go with, like, make it an open world platformer? Do you want to make it? There's all sorts of different high level structures that you could go for, and a lot of that is going to also inform what sort of a narrative you're wrapping it in, because the context of what you're doing makes a big difference. You could have the same mechanic, you could dress it as a future sport and strip away any sort of storyline to it, and just say sort of like these are just a series of abstract challenges, and just run with that. But you might be losing the like the side of the market that likes to have a story and a bit of a motivation to do it. So if you look at like Zelda Breath of the Wild, all of the dungeons are very abstract, mm-hmm. kind of like things that just happen in an empty void, accessed from the overworld, but they're framed as ancient temples that you unlock stuff by completing. So, the very like thin narrative framework to that, but more traditionally, something like a corridor shooter will have like a series of levels that are basically all shooter levels, but they'll mix it up. They'll have like one that is very sort of like tight and claustrophobic, and then they'll have one that is a bit more sort of like wide open with where you have a little bit more exploration to do. Then maybe they'll put a vehicle level in for variety and stuff like that. So that structure and what you're going to put in will inform your scope. And also, for example, if you stick a vehicle level into a game that is otherwise a shooter, that's a whole separate mechanic. And that is going to require the team to spend time developing the vehicle handling and allowing the player to get in and out of the vehicle, or unless you're just locked in the vehicle for the entire level. All of these are choices that that have to be at some point, preferably quite early on. And if you can design out complexities like have the player being able to get in and out of the vehicle, mm-hmm. by saying, oh, well, you'll get in the vehicle in a cutscene and you'll stay in the vehicle until the end of the level and the next cutscene.
Yeah.
You can design away some of the challenges.
Yeah, I guess as well, like if you can always look at what you're building and change the game to fit a scope that you're more comfortable with. So you could take it down to something for mobile, and then you've got a much simpler mechanic base to play from, or at least you would assume that you're working towards a simpler mechanic base if you're trying to lower the scope. So yeah, there's lots of ways to do that, right? So the next, we're going to move on from Discovery and move into production and what are considered production milestones. which tend to be something like prototype, first playable, pre-alpha, vertical slice, which is kind of optional-ish. Then you move into actual alpha, then beta, then you have your release candidate, and that's roughly the road to release. It's certainly one version of it, isn't it? Because I know that there are, I've seen quite a few images pop up on my Twitter feed recently. People who have created like little meme images of the production scheduling, and there's so much of it where at any point you could be led into a dead end. Like, you can create your prototype and you go, oh no, that no, yeah, it's not even got legs. It gets to first playable and you're like, oh god, this is gonna be like too big a scope or whatever. You get as far as vertical slice and then you realize that actually you might need to change the art style because that's going to blow up your scope. And then alpha, beta, there's a whole host of like bugs, and when you get to that stage, energy levels can be quite low.
I would argue that there's a bit of an overlap between sort of discovery and prototyping in that stage. But yeah, you're absolutely right. At any point during production, you need to be constantly course correcting to make sure that what you're doing is going to be viable. And this is why it's important to have a producer who's keeping an eye on that stuff. And going sort of like, well, it's taken us like 2 months to get this like first playable level done in this art style. It was the art that took us a long time to do because the mechanics were already working. So at that rate, if we want to do the full sort of like 16 levels that we've got designed, that's going to take us like two more years. We don't have time for that or budget for that. So we're going to have to cut some. So in terms of managing scope, like maybe you just want to cut content as in levels. So you've just got less volume to do. Maybe it would be okay to have 16 levels, but we need to cut one of the mechanics, which is making the levels difficult to design. So it could be that like the fact that you've got a grappling hook means that you can, it's easy to escape the level, and it adds a whole bunch of additional design time and bug fixing time.
You know, that would be a real pain in the bum if, from your original example, if you had chosen to add a grappling hook into a game because you were playing a game and you're like, a grappling hook would be really good for this. And then you go into it and you make it and you're like, oh no, the grappling hook ruins the game.
Yeah, exactly. Or it creates a whole bunch. I mean, if the whole game is designed around it, then fair enough. Yeah. So for example, in that case, a good design for that game would be a bunch of platforms floating in the sky that you grapple between, because that gives you very clear, you know, the only parts of the level that exist are the bits that you can interact with. And that kind of like slightly surreal execution works fine. If you were making a standard corridor shooter but you had a grappling hook, suddenly all of the verticality of the level would not just be scenery, because you wouldn't just be moving around on the floor on the ground level. You would suddenly be able to attach to things, and that would allow you to go up the skyscrapers on either side of the street and so on, which creates a lot of complexity. If you look at something like Dishonored, there's a lot of incredibly tall buildings with no like features up the sides of it, because they have to have some way of bounding the level to stop you from getting out with your short range teleport. So it creates some like design difficulties doing it that way. Another good example was when I worked at TT Games, we did a first person shooter based around the like Lego Bionicle characters.
Nice.
Up until that point, the Lego games had all been kind of like platformy games, and like the only collision that we put in the level was just enough to like get across the platforms that you could access. Everything that you could see in the background, if you couldn't get to it, it didn't have collision. As soon as you have a first person shooter, if you can see it, you can shoot at it, and you need the bullets not to pass through the scenery. So suddenly we had to put collision on everything instead of just everything you could see. We needed to like have like ricochet particles come off when you shot it. And that was like a massive additional workload compared to the platform levels where you were tightly constrained. So things like that will affect it. But yeah, I mean, I think there's plenty of talk about sort of like the progress of vertical slice to alpha to beta and so on. But the key thing for me is that you have to be constantly reviewing the scope of the game and adjusting things, and then maybe going sort of like, okay, these levels we're just not going to ship on time unless we push these levels to be like DLC or cut them entirely. There's constant compromises in the development process.
So there are some studios obviously kind of skip having a vertical slice, and there are other studios that kind of swear by getting to vertical slice before progressing any further. Is there anything particularly that you would say is a driving force for that? Is it just that, because I, for example, I know with my studio, we're working towards a vertical slice because we want to take that to investors and publishers and say, this is exactly what we're building. This is a slice of what we're building. We're just going to make more of it. And obviously we explain the depth of how we're going to build that out. Do you reckon that's the key driver, or do you think there are other factors as to why someone might want to?
I think for most studios, vertical slice is essential. You need to have that, you know, for people who don't know, the vertical slice is basically like a slice of cake. You know, it's a cut through the game, and it shows all of the layers of the game, but it's
with
but
all
it's
the
just a smaller amount than a full cake. So the vertical slice is important to be able to show to your publisher or your Kickstarter backers or whoever what the game is going to be. So that's really important. There's a few cases where you might not need it if you are, for example, if you're a big studio and you're working on like the third Uncharted game or something like that, you probably don't really need a vertical slice for a game that you're doing like a sequel to. You would still need to prototype any new mechanics. So let's take Assassin's Creed Black Flag, where you have boats. You don't need to vertical slice the running around rooftops stuff because you've done like two or three previous games. We know what that's
a good idea of the scope.
Know what how that's supposed to play. The tricky bit will be sort of like, how does that integrate with sailing a boat? You know, presumably you're going to be able to climb up the masts and stuff. That would make sense, and climb in the rigging, and then leap across to another boat. So that stuff, the new things, you would definitely try to prototype. But yeah, if it's something that where you have a very clear idea what you're trying to make, there's probably less and you don't need to show it to somebody else for approval or for to raise funding and so on. You can just like plow ahead and like go for the for the end goal. But most studios are going to have to at some point show it to a publisher or the public to say sort of like, here's what we're making, we need your support.
I think the reason why it is quite prevalent in the spaces that we move in is because in the indie space there is always this like you say, someone that you're going to need to explain and showcase exactly what it is you're trying to make. Whereas, like you say, if you're a bigger studio, or even, I think probably if you're like a solo developer, and I'm talking about those solo developers that tend to either are kind of more hobbyist, or the ones that don't look for publishers or for social verification on what they're doing, they just do it because they're doing what they want to do. They seem to tend to skip Vertical Slice because they know where they're going and they're just on the journey there.
Yeah,
but definitely in the indie spaces, Vertical Slice is essential for us, isn't it?
It is. Yeah.
So testing, as we've said, it's very important for us that testing happens at pretty much at all stages.
Yeah.
But it comes in most heavily, I would say, around prototype to from prototype to release, because you're constantly changing things and updating things, and you're at a certain stage you're getting player feedback. Are there any like major errors or levels that are like problematic? Is everything rendering on the screen? Are there walls that characters can walk through that you just didn't realize, like someone's forgot to put in colliders or whatever? And things like for the player journey, are there areas where a player actually just gets stuck because you haven't given enough signposting or UX feedback for the player to figure out what they need to do? And then I guess lastly is things like, if you've got dialogue in your game, is it compelling? Like, have you done that right? Is how that's delivered correct? Have you got any story of like a particular testing nightmare? Because I think those are always good.
I've got some stories of some like QA triumphs that I was quite impressed with. I mean, generally for QA, big picture, there's three elements to that. There's the focus testing that you were talking about, which is the much softer kind of, not actually necessarily looking for bugs, but just does this create the right mood for the player? Does it engage? Does it keep their attention for long enough? And so on. That tends to be that tends to require focus testing. You need to show it to people who have not seen it before. You need a fresh audience to get that, because your QA team, who may be coming onto it halfway through production, or maybe that some of them, like the core QA team, might have been working on it since your first prototype, depending on like the scale of your team and your studio.
Mm-hmm.
The more subjective stuff like that, you tend to have to look to external focus testing, because you need fresh eyes.
Yeah.
Your internal or your publisher's QA team will be more useful for the more like nitty gritty bugs, of which there's two types. There's the kind of like known unknowns, as in bugs that you expect to be there, like places that where the, like the collision doesn't quite match the geometry, or places you can escape the level, things that you expect to be wrong in a few places. And then there's unknown unknowns, which is where QA discovers something really wild that you didn't expect at all. One of my favorite QA stories was on Lego Batman 2, where we had an open world hub for the first time. And let's see, we had to stop the player from escaping the island that Gotham was on, we put a line all the way around over the sea, which if you tried to take a boat or a plane out that far, if you tried to swim out that far, you'd get eaten by a shark. If you tried to take a vehicle that would protect you from the sharks, we've just put a turnaround spline out there. So you'd hit that spline and it would basically like turn the vehicle around until it was heading back towards Gotham and then give you control back again.
Right.
However, we only want that, it's expensive to test the vehicle against a spline all the time. So we only did that if for the like player controlled vehicles. So the like all of the like NPC vehicles driving around and stuff like that wouldn't be testing against that spline because we didn't expect them to try to escape the level.
Right.
And somehow QA discovered that what you could do to escape the hub was fly the Batwing out towards the this turnaround spline, and as you approached it, you could hop out of the Batwing, but land on the Batwing, and then you could surf the Batwing through the spline because the Batwing was now not player controlled.
Right.
It didn't trigger the turnaround spline, and then once you were out. Past the spline, you could get back into the Batwing and you were out of the level. I have no clue how QA even knew to try that.
Yeah.
But that's the level of exploit that you really need QA to find. And it requires, there are certain people who are like really good at discovering those exploits. I would argue that like speedrunners would make incredibly good like QA staff because that's their bag. They are looking for like little flaws that they can exploit to shave a few seconds off. And it's that exact sort of mindset that is very hard for like programmers and artists to test their own game because like you want it to work. Programmers in particular are like terrible testers because we subconsciously play the game the way we expect it to work. It requires a real effort of will to play the game in a way that breaks it. And so
there's a kid that I'm aware of that is kind of famous throughout the games expos. You might have heard about him. If he comes over to your game, it's a bit of a double-edged sword because if he comes over to your game, you're almost certainly guaranteed that he will find a bug. And in many cases, I've seen him break games at showcase expos where, in fact, the last one that I saw, somehow he managed to unload like all of the textures and everything went into like a black shaded environment apart from the sky for some reason, so you could kind of see everything was just like black shaded. And
wow.
the indies that were showcasing their game were both like there was two of them and they were just looking at each other like I don't know how we would have known that was something you could do. So in one way it's like really good that you can get that bug out of your game, but in another way, it's like you were showcasing live and this kid just destroyed your game.
Yeah. I mean, that's fantastic. That kid's destined to be a QA lead.
He absolutely is, yeah.
It's really useful, actually. I've taken a game to a show and it was quite a grueling one, actually. 4 solid days of exhibiting most of which I was standing up. It was exhausting, but I would make notes as I was watching people play the game on not just like bugs that they found, but also like the way that they learned the game, because most people were playing it for the first time. And it was noticeable that people would turn round to me going sort of like, I don't know what I've got to do. And what they had to do was written across the screen in front of them. But because they still had control of the camera, they were just ignoring it. People will ignore text completely. It's fascinating because it's not, that's not the thing that interests them. But I would go back to the hotel room every night after that show, fix the bugs that I'd witnessed that day, and then make a new build for the next day. And that 4 days, because it was a project that I was the sole developer on, for those 4 days, using the public as QA, I fixed so much stuff. It was extremely useful. You need people other than yourselves to find this stuff. because you when you know how, exactly how the game works, you are going to, you're not going to try the things that are going to cause problems. You need that fresh perspective.
I think friends and family also only really get you so far, because they don't, for the most part, they don't want to break your game. And they want to be like your best cheerleaders and stuff. Some people are fortunate enough that, you know, they have friends who are in QA, and so it's like quite nice to have them playtest. But I tend to find that showcasing games is definitely where you find quite a lot of stuff that you just wouldn't find through friends and family. And then if you can afford it, getting some professional QA in is always useful for testing purposes.
Professional QA is a godsend, and I can't underscore enough how difficult a job it is. Because I think it's undervalued in the industry, because it is seen as a kind of like, oh, you just need to like know how to play the game. Right. You know, you just, so anybody who's played a video game could be a QA tester. And to a certain extent, that's true. They can play the game and they can write down the bugs that they find. But the trouble is that you don't want just sort of like a random gamer playing your game. What you want is someone who has that particular talent for finding problems. They want to poke at the edges of the game. You don't want someone who's just going to play the game the way it's meant to be played and enjoy it. You want someone who's got that psychology for poking at the edges and repeating the same thing over and over again with different, slightly different tweaks. I mean, you were asking before about like QA stories. We had a crash bug in one of the Lego games, which was fairly consistent if you played through, but we couldn't reproduce it when we were testing the level. We eventually, one of the QA team eventually discovered that it would crash if you did a certain thing in the previous level. And the reason was because doing that certain thing was like modifying a memory leak thing. It was modifying a little bit of memory that was then staying modified until the next level loaded, and then you play through that, and then it would access this bit of modified memory and it would crash. But in order for it to crash, you had to have like the some data in there, because if it was clean empty memory, it didn't crash. I have no clue how they discovered of all of the things that you did in the previous level, it was that one, because they found, you know, we've quite quickly figured that you could play, if you played through the previous level and then played through the following level, then like it would crash, but we didn't know what exactly was doing it. But it took a QA tester to like narrow it down to precisely which. I think what they did was that they would play through it a certain distance and then like skip to the next level. So that, and they may have binary chopped it to say sort of play halfway through the preceding level and then skip. It doesn't crash. It must be something that we do in the latter half of that level. And eventually they figured out like that it was one specific puzzle that caused it.
Yeah, just incredible, isn't it?
That it is. It's
you literally do need someone who, like you say, doesn't just play the game, but understands more so like how games are made and what things in there might be causing it. And some degree as well, being able to know what it was that they did while they were playing so that they can try and replicate it again.
And the patience,
don't get that with normal people.
The patience to be able to reliably go through a sort of like specific sequence of the same steps and do it the same way every time in the same order, and then change one thing to see if that makes a difference, and make an accurate record of exactly what they did and what they did differently. That patience, and also obviously like being able to then like supply us with a video that shows sort of like, this is what I did. If you do the exact same thing, but you don't do this, then the bug doesn't happen. That is invaluable for as developers, because then you can go sort of like, okay, I'll, you know, I don't understand why that would do it, but I will follow the instructions that the QA team provided, and like, lo and behold, now it crashes. You know, the number of times that like program, not just myself, but like programmers that I've worked with have got that, like, this can't be what causes it. It doesn't, it makes no sense. And then you play it through, and like, QA were dead right. And like, once you've caught it in the debugger, you can look at it and go, oh, that is why. And often it's not exactly what, like, sometimes like QA will say it's this thing that causes it, and you go through and you can look at that thing, and that thing seems rock solid, and then you when you actually catch it, you find that it was that thing, but there's nothing wrong with that thing. It was because something in a previous level like corrupted something in an otherwise working system.
It has a knock-on effect.
It's very, very important that because you just can't ship without fixing all of those critical bugs.
And speaking of shipping, we're going to move on to release. So on the build up to release, like we say, all of this testing has happened, and you're normally furiously, especially if you've got you should have a set date for release. you've projected it, you've announced it, and in the weeks and months before release, you're frantically trying to fix all of those things found in testing, frantically trying to find out if there's any, I guess you, for release, you're just looking for major ones, like you when you're in this, like, the final stretch, you're no longer looking broadly, you're looking for anything that will just make release horrendous, like half characters' bodies not loading and stuff like that.
Yeah,
might have happened in some games recently. In addition to that, obviously there's a lot of work going into marketing, letting your player base know, hopefully along the path to release, you've either been doing some community building around your game, making sure that the audience fan base either exists, or if there is an existing fan base, reaching out to them and letting them know all of this wonderful stuff is coming up. But it can be a real nightmare, right?
Oh yeah, shipping a game on time is a nightmare, because you have to pick a date, because you have to have the marketing build up. You need to spend like 12, like at least sort of like 6 months, if not like a full year, depending on how many you want to sell. You need to spend that time building up the like awareness of the game. Otherwise it's not going to have an audience when it launches. If you just slip something out onto Steam on the day of release and nobody knows about it, it's going to sink. I've done that. It sank. So you have to pick a ship date and aim towards that. But you also need all of the critical bugs to be shipped. If you're shipping on console, for example, you have to submit it to Nintendo, Microsoft and Sony and get it certified to say sort of like, yes, this is good enough quality to go on our platform. So all of the stuff that they raise about like performance and about the particular way that it behaves, those have all got to be fixed. Otherwise, you are literally not allowed to sell it on that platform. So those are the highest priority. But then there's other bugs that are maybe cosmetic bugs, where sort of like, yeah, sometimes like part of a character's body disappears or something, that are maybe they seem incredibly rare. The difficulty with incredibly rare bugs is that even if it only happens 1% of the time, once you ship it to sort of like 100,000 people, that's 1,000 people who see that bug. And somebody's going to clip it and post it online, and this is where you get comedy, Assassin's Creed, floating eyeballs, and stuff like that. Because you know it's really hard to fix everything on time. The way that And this is why stuff gets postponed. And this is why, like, Nintendo famously are happy to postpone their games and postpone them and postpone them until they're good and ready. And that, because they prioritize the quality of their product over the ship date. It helps that they have an incredibly good reputation for that as well. And people are willing to wait for the, you know, the big Nintendo games, the first, so that your Zelda, your Mario, and so on, because they have created that reputation. If you, on the flip side of that, if you go to like the Assassin's Creed model of trying to just like ship something once a year, that's an incredibly punishing schedule to hit. And that is how you end up with like just some bugs just don't get fixed because they weren't quite important enough. And anything that is cosmetic, so it looks ugly, but it doesn't break the game, those are the ones that tend to get left in because, you know, the it's not that the devs are being lazy. It's that the devs busted their asses to fix the stuff that would break your save game or crash the game and you'd like have to restart the level and so on. All of those
most
things
of the time that, they don't know about the
exactly all of those things that like players are not aware of, all of the stuff that would absolutely like really create frustration for the customer. Those things do get fixed. The stuff that is kind of like more likely to provoke kind of like a laugh and like you, but it fixes itself because like, you know, okay, these characters are broken in the cutscene, but the cutscene finishes and gameplay is fine and you resume and everything, the rest of the game is fine.
You can still forward. Play the game.
That's it's a lesser bug. It kicks you out of the game, you know, it kicks you out of being immersed in the game, seeing a bug like that. But that is preferable to losing your progress or bombing back to the dashboard or something.
Anything game crashing, just mega no-no.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So, and also you have to schedule when you are going to submit stuff to be certified by console holders, platform holders, ahead of time as well. And so like this is where you end up with like games that get sort of like delayed at the last minute, because it means that basically there was a problem where you were going to lose your progress or the game was going to crash that they just couldn't find the solution for in time because, you know, they had other stuff. And usually it's not that like, even with a big team, this can be a problem because, you know, generally, like, it's not the artists and the animators and the, like, audio team who are fixing bugs. It's only the coders, and it's only the coders who understand the particular system that is a problem. So if you've got a crash like that, it generally falls on the shoulders of maybe two or three programmers at most who understand that particular system well enough to be able to fix it. And if they have been crunching for like months to get it to the state that it's in, sometimes the producers just have to say sort of like, we have to give this individual a bit more time. And that can be suck if it's your fault, if it feels like it's your fault, if the game is shit, it has to be postponed by a few weeks or a month because you weren't able to fix the problem, but it happens, you know, because you've been busting a gut to fix all of the other stuff. So, you know, and it's not like that was your sole responsibility to get that fixed for launch. You were busy fixing all of the other stuff for launch that needed to be done. So
this all brings us quite nicely actually into the last part of this, which is post-release.
Yes.
So post-release being the game's out there now, those little bugs that players are finding are being seen, and after the release of the game, we tend to in our studios we set depending on the studio we tend to set a small team who are tasked with fixing the bugs that are being found, creating patches, or we if there's not too many bugs and problems, then we also look at adding in bonuses, or depending on the game type, in-game events or brand new content like DLC, downloadable content that we're going to add to give the game more life beyond its release date, so that we have the audience are given a game and they're like, hooray, and then we're like, there's more coming, and we, you know, keep our audience happy. And it's quite common for studios to do the batches for when it comes to bug fixing at this point.
I will actually, like, just to pause you there, before you get to that point, there is the horror of the day one patch, which is generally, from what I was just talking about, is the stuff that was not quite important enough to block it from being certified. So it was good enough to ship, but it may have some like ugly bugs in it that you desperately want to be fixed before the players see it. That is the sort of stuff that tends to like end up in the day one patch, where but you know, you still have to like ship, like get discs printed, because it takes time for to like burn Blu-rays and put them in boxes and get them shipped to stores for that like critical release date. That's where the day one patch happens, because you know, even with 3 weeks to go before the launch date, you have to have a gold master 3 weeks ahead. But if there's some ugly stuff that you want fixing, that 3 weeks is valuable time that is this bit of breathing space. You can fix a bunch of stuff and then push out a day one patch, so that people who have bought the game on release can plug it in. They get their day one patch, which fixes stuff that would still have been an ugly problem if they played the gold master version. So
I guess like some of this is potentially less of a problem as we move to all things being digital, in terms of the speed.
Yes. Yeah, that's true.
But there still is that time, right? Because you still have to upload, like you say, for each platform, you need to upload something, because you told that platform this was the release date, and they will expect you to release on the date that you said you're going to release on, barring whatever agreement you have for pushing back release dates. But yeah, once you've said, no, it's coming tomorrow, it's coming tomorrow, then they will expect it. And from that point, yeah, you're going to, I guess it's at this point where it's very useful for us to have, this is where we branch off builds, right? We have the main build that is going for release, and then we've branched off a copy of that build, and we're patching and fixing. And then when we're able to, and we're ready and we're happy, we plug that in.
I mean, that's a very good point, actually, that is, I guess it kind of like falls into the sort of like deeper dive into production, but like managing all of the different versions of the game, because obviously a lot of the game is shared between all of the different platforms. If you're doing a multi-platform project, at some point you're going to have to split it and say sort of like, right, we are now going to split off the Xbox version because we've sent it to Microsoft. Mm-hmm. So we do not want people changing stuff to make it like make the like Switch version faster. That risks breaking the Xbox version. So you end up with an entire copy of the game for each platform, and potentially sort of like a separate copy for the day one patch, which you may have like already branched off, and having to like merge changes from one branch to another. If you discover a crash bug in the Xbox version, it's like, oh, this is going to happen on all platforms. And then suddenly like, okay, we've now got to go and fix that in like three more places to make sure that it doesn't happen on any of those platforms. And it's a bit of a nightmare. You try to like put off splitting the projects until the last minute, but at some point you've got to do that so that you can guarantee that the version that you sent to Xbox, and like you can then, you've got a copy of that so that you can change only the things that Microsoft required you to fix, because changing anything else risks introducing new bugs.
Yeah. Is there a particular, for you, is there a particular type of game format that you prefer when it comes to post-release shenanigans, in that do you prefer to make games that will have DLC? Do you prefer to have games that will just need bug fixing and then you move on to the next project?
Yeah, or? I mean, it's a tricky one, because I haven't worked on enormous amounts of DLC projects, to be honest. It does introduce a bit of complexity, because you need to make sure that the game, the DLC, which is effectively a patch for the game nowadays, yeah, really, you need to make sure that that patch isn't ridiculously big. So it does mean that you have to put a bit more effort into chopping up the game data into neat and tidy sections, so that because like Nintendo have limits on the size of patches, for example, and if all of your game data is too interrelated, you can end up by fixing some stuff, or like touching like what the tiniest thing in a level, it requires the entire level to be included into the patch, and like you end up with patch bloat, and that is how you end up with like day one patches that are many, many gigabytes. It's because, you know, there was a hole in the level was fixed so that you couldn't fall out of the level, and that has required the entire level to be re-downloaded,
right,
just to fix that tiny tiny issue. So if you can take the time to split your content up into smaller chunks, you can make it so that it's easier to make gameplay fixes without the entire art needing to be re-downloaded, and so on. So,
with that in mind, would your preference be that you could just go, there's the game I've made, if the audience loves it and they want more of it, then let's make the next game?
I mean, ideally, I think the ideal is to like ship a game that is perfect and have people enjoy it, obviously, but that butts up against the reality of all of the stuff that I've just talked about. And the bigger the game is, the more complicated it is and the harder it is to make it perfect. So the ability to patch things, I think is really useful. And also to like player feedback, for example, The Witcher 3, patching it to make the text larger on consoles. You know, that came after they'd fixed all of the more critical stuff. But that was a godsend, because it meant I could sit slightly, I didn't have to sort of like sit on the edge of the sofa craning forward to try to read the text.
Right.
It's a classic problem that developers are sitting 2 feet away from a nice big monitor. Yeah. They can see small text on that, no problem. It's not, you know, it's at TT, the designers and producers would always test the game in one of the meeting rooms where the TV, where we had sofas and the TV across the room. It was much closer to a kind of like a shipping environment. So if you couldn't make stuff out from across the room on a big TV, then that would be a problem. So that's something that's worth obviously testing. But the ability to like incorporate player feedback, and I've shipped a game in which obviously there was a bunch of bugs to fix. I had like issues with achievements. I shipped a game that crashed on boot because if you didn't have a save game already, and of course nobody had a save game.
Right.
So I had to like emergency patch that in the small hours of the morning, the day after release. And the only reason I knew about that is because I sent a key to a YouTuber that I know, and they played it immediately and discovered that it crashed. And that's because that was a solo project and I was the only person testing it.
Yeah.
And I omitted a key part of that process of testing it on a different machine. So that's an example. But then, so once I cleared all of that stuff, then I was able to look at the Steam reviews, for example, and go most people thought it was too easy. So I was able to patch it to make it a bit harder. That sort of feedback, I think, is really useful.
Yeah, for sure. With the game that I'm currently making, that mysteriously I'm not talking too much about.
Always the way.
Yeah, but people can go to the website and find out.
The
thing is, I can never remember what I've agreed that I will and won't talk about, so I just don't talk about it. I just go, check out what we've put on the website, and you'll know exactly what we're doing. But yeah, the thinking with what we're doing right now is that we're going to get a whole load of feedback from a showcase that we're looking to do in July, and then full steam towards, hoping to get publisher backing, and then full steam in production to get it to release. And then from release, we're not expecting to do too much work in terms of DLC and extra content. I really just want to get as much feedback as possible from the audience, and from the fan base, presuming that there will be a fan base, and just go with whatever the audience asks us for. So if the audience says, we loved this, we want more of it, because my games are always very narrative driven, and there's a whole world building thing behind it, I have a couple of options open to me. I can either say to my audience, look, I can deliver more of the world to you, but in a different game, or I can deliver you, if you've really loved the game format, then I can give you more of the world in more of this similar kind of game format. So that's almost my preference, is that I can just build, release, move on to the next one. Obviously we'll patch any fixes and stuff, but
I guess it very much depends on the particular technical details of the project, because in some cases you might be very happy with the technical side of things and happy to pleased with what you've made and just happy to make more content for that game, which would be good. You may find flip side of that is that you might find that it was a bit of a technical nightmare and you don't want to work with the constraints that you had to deliver the first game with, and you want to fix things in, you want to work on a different game where you could fix a bunch of stuff that was frustrating or that you think didn't work properly, or eliminate some stuff that you feel isn't working the way that you intended. And it's very hard to cut stuff from a game once you've shipped it, because the players who have who have got that content will complain if you take it away from them again. But with the grappling hook example, maybe you find that the grappling hook didn't add enough to the game to make it worthwhile. It created new problems, and it didn't, it could be that that's because of compromises that had to be made during development and so on. Maybe you want to do a game that really supports the grappling hook properly, and therefore you want to make a game that is smaller but really does it justice. So there's stuff like that. It's interesting nowadays that we've also got I grew up with games that were shipped once and that was it. They were done.
Yeah, that was it.
Once you'd put it on floppy disks or CD-ROMs or whatever, and it had gone out to shops, that was it. You couldn't make any changes to it. Once more people were online, then that brought in the ability to patch stuff to fix things later, which was helpful. But it has also got us to the point where we are now, where we have live games that are constantly being updated and tweaked and improved. And that I see as a bit of a nightmare, because how do you take if you're finding that a feature is, it creates the problem of players getting upset when you nerf a weapon because it's imbalanced, but the players like it because they've identified that it's imbalanced and they enjoy like exploiting it to get that. And then they will complain if you rebalance things, or they will.
I think definitely that used to be more of a thing. Like my guilty pleasure, as I've mentioned probably quite a few times now, is Clash Royale. And because that game, like over the last 10 years has developed and evolved, and there are so many new components to it now, and they're always really like open and transparent with their audience, that because it's like a card-based battling system, that those cards, especially when they bring in new cards, there needs to be a rebalancing, and they are constantly balancing and rebalancing the characters that you're able to play. And they've kind of created this, what would you call it? They've like normalized it to the point where when you see players like live streaming Clash Royale, people who are talking to them in chat will go, oh, that card needs a nerf, like, or that card needs a buff. Like, it's become part of a conversation for them.
Yeah, yeah. It's an interesting one. From a business perspective, of course, the reason that we have live games is because if you create a whole new game to explore more of the world or to address problems that you felt you had with the first one, you've got to somehow move your audience across from the first game to the second one, as well as drawing more people in. So live games, on the other hand, because you're constantly updating the same game, you are never leaving any of your like players behind. And particularly if it's something that has got, if it's a game that is funded by microtransactions and so on, you don't ever want to reduce your player base, because that's your income.
Yeah, your number one priority becomes retention.
Exactly. So, which is why like it is important to keep the game, keep managing the game, keep making sure that it is balanced, it is fair, so that it doesn't frustrate players and make them want to give up. But also bringing new things in that keep the existing players interested in the game, so they don't run out of stuff to explore. There's a lot of different things to balance, because obviously that depends on the business model. That works for something like Clash Royale, which is microtransactions. But if it was something where the players just like pay once for the game, then continuously patching it doesn't really win you anything, unless you are charging for DLC that also happens to be a patch. But then if it's an optional DLC, you can't be patching critical bugs in the main game in an optional DLC. Because you would have to patch the game and then also have the DLC as a separate download. So that creates a bit more work. You know, there's a lot of different variables.
Like, live games seem like a ball and chain. As a creative person, I could not live with.
Yeah.
But I think we've managed to cover quite well, actually, everything that I had planned for us to talk about today. So this has loosely been the five stages of game development. Like we've said, there's deep dives to be had, and in some cases there's some people either have fewer stages or are able to work with fewer stages, but that's a general overview that I think is a good base for anyone who is interested in making games to take a look at as way of process. Chris, where can people find you online?
I am still just about on Twitter at Quixotl, Quixotl, or you can find me at quantum-soup.com.
Lovely. And I'm at Stuart DeVille everywhere online. A quick Google, if you're interested, you can find me everywhere. But this has been a wonderful episode of the Game to Learn podcast. I hope you all agree. And we, if you don't already know, we drop episodes every Monday. And we have been doing so now for nearly 3 years. So there's quite a lot. There's quite a lot for you to jump into and listen to. Also, we have a Discord community if you'd like to join us in Discord and talk about things discussed in this episode or others. You can go to gamedev.london/join, or you can just visit the website gamedev.london, and you'll have access to everything that we do, because we have a podcast, we have a community, we do events and expos and game jams and a whole bunch of stuff for anyone who is either in game development, looking to get into game development, or just loves learning about game development. So thanks for joining us. And we will see you next week.